Welcome to The Author Meets the Critics, presented each week at this time from the RCA Exhibit Hall in Radio City, where today's guest is Monty Soane, author of a new novel. Its title, The Flesh and Mary Duncan. Now, in a moment, Mr. Soane will meet his critics face to face, no holds barred in a literary free-for-all. But first, meet the man who keeps the peace on these programs, John K.M. McCaffrey.
In The Flesh and Mary Duncan, Monty Soane, a former newspaper and advertising man and now an executive in one of the nation's largest food companies, tells in a new way the troubled story of a veteran's need to rediscover himself when he comes home from the wars. Young George Trapple, typically American in his individualism and in his rebellion against following the green line of tradition, returns to his father's flourishing factory in Ohio, his nerves bruised by the death and destruction he has seen abroad and confused in his own mind about his own future. Inevitably, his parents, who have not seen what he saw, fail to understand George's inner struggle. Inevitably, his father expects him to take his place in the business, to marry Mary, the girl who has waited out the long months of war for him, and to settle down in the community pattern to which he was born. But George cannot fit himself into the waiting mold, nor can he communicate his distress to his parents. Even with Mary, who always understood him, he cannot bridge the gap that yawns between them. Because Mary has the courage and loyalty to swallow her hurt pride, the long-expected wedding takes place. But their marriage only serves to heighten George's tension. The two young people reach the last edge of disaster before the drama mounting between them is at last resolved. Here, in brief, is the story of The Flesh and Mary Duncan. And now let's hear from our critics. First, the staff writer for the forthcoming new magazine, The Reporter, Mr. Gouverneur Paulding.
Well, Mr. McCaffrey, this book seems to me a sort of nature boy. In the sense that its pages are made out of paper, and the paper comes from trees, and the ink and the characters, the ink comes from squashed beetles or something, and the writing comes from an equally primeval innocence as to how to make characters living and real.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Paulding, but with a very different point of view, the well-known book reviewer, Virgilia Peterson.
Well, I like The Flesh and Mary Duncan, and I like it, I think, most of all because of its underlying theme, because of its what it's trying to say. Most people have a tendency to mock at the fact that there's been a great deal of mental disturbance among the veterans returning from this war. And I think Mr. Soane handles this theme in a way to make it quite obvious that there is no room for mockery, that we are a peace-loving people brought up to love peace, and that if we have to see mass slaughter, it's only too natural that it throws our men into confusion. And for that reason, I honor the handling of this story.
The critics are in complete disagreement, which is just as it should be. But before letting Mr. Soane and our critics have at each other, here is a message of special interest.
The Author Meets the Critics is campaigning for you to send new popular books to veterans in hospitals. Today we want to talk about the Kingsbridge Hospital in the Bronx. Kingsbridge has the best basic library of old established authors in the New York area. But Kingsbridge patients are eager readers, and they ask for new books. Many of them want to read the present crop of war novels. 2 years ago, when they were first brought home, they had no interest in books about the war. Now they've changed. You see, explained General DeVee, the head of Kingsbridge, himself a believer in the curative value of books, many of our men have felt as if their experiences in the war were peculiar to them alone. Reading books like The Naked and the Dead and The Young Lions, they realize that a lot of other veterans are in the same boat. It makes them feel better. They feel less lonely and, most important, less disturbed. Books help these lonely men to escape from themselves. Start this year by sending a new book to the disabled veterans at Kingsbridge Hospital, the Bronx, New York. And now, here's John McCaffrey.
Mr. Paulding, do you want to expand those vicious remarks with which you opened the program?
Boy, they weren't very vicious. I'd like, first of all, to get rid of one part of this discussion quickly. Get it off our chest at once, because you shouldn't devote much time to it. And that is the quality of the writing. It seems to me that it achieves a fantastic success in being flat in absolutely every register, flat in statement, flat when it's excited. I'm not going to start picking out things out of this book, because it's always unfair, and as I say, I don't think we ought to fuss with this at all. But I just will read a sentence or two, picked absolutely and honestly at random. He faced her for a moment, half expectant that she might speak, yet hoping she would not. The emotion within her was close to outburst. I think I need a little fresher air. Now, that's when he's writing quite calmly. Now, when he really gets going, when it's really the climax and the excitement at the end of the book, He has just this phrase. He bent over and put a hand upon the warmth of her. A pleasant warmth. I don't know about putting hands on the warmth. I don't know. It's awfully bad. I think we can finish with the quality of the writing.
Well,
so,
I think that we now need some pleasant warmth from Miss Peterson.
Well, all I can say is that your arabesques of literary criticism sound slightly inhuman. I don't think this is a literary job. I don't think Mr. Sohn pretends to be a divinely inspired poet or a professional writer. What he's trying to do is to get over a story which he very obviously and very sincerely feels. I don't know, Mr. Pauling, perhaps you have no patience with neurosis in general. Perhaps it doesn't interest you. But in fact, Mr. Soane's handling of George Trapple's neurosis, the fact that the boy himself knows that he has one and still can't put his finger on what it is, that he has suspicions, sudden rages, attacks of rebellion, distress of all kinds, and tries to cope with these symptoms, knowing that they are symptoms of something and cannot cope with them, is an extraordinarily sympathetic layman's treatment of a thing which, alas, is not common only to veterans who've been in the war, but to many other people suffering the stress and strain and challenge of contemporary life.
Miss Peterson, it really is wonderful to see your kind and bleeding heart all over the place for these characters. You haven't got the reputation on this program for being as terribly emotional about a subject which you admit at once is badly
written.
If this
is terribly emotional, Mr. Pauling, you'd better pull yourself together because I have more
stuff coming
to pull
out.
You
have reserves, Miss Peterson?
I still have
reserves. Look, Miss Peterson, this boy, first of all, it's awfully hard to talk nastily about this boy because he is a veteran. We all know they have troubles. We all know they have problems, and there's such a thing as battle shock. We've got the greatest sympathy for him. What I'd like to say at once is that for a product of Yale, he's the dumbest product of Yale, and that's saying a lot.
Yes, Mr.
That's
Pauling.
That's from a Harvard man, of course. I can tell by the accent.
Well, now, don't give away things. That isn't on the program. Well, where I come from, I don't think it matters. He does not seem to do any thinking. He has a trouble which is almost a mechanical trouble. It is there. He did have a horrible time in the war, and as I say, lots of other soldiers, and as you say, lots of people who weren't soldiers also have neuroses. I've got no objection to a neurosis. I've got an objection, a fundamental objection to this story. I think it should have stayed out in East Middleton. You started out with quite an interesting business about a great big company taking over a medium-sized company. That study, I think, could have been interesting. I think the appallingly dull and horribly illiterate milieu of both the medium company personnel and the big company personnel, they're indistinguishable in a sort of country club horror of a small manufacturing town, might have made an interesting study. And my fundamental
Just a minute,
objection...
Mr. Pauling, before you write that novel here, Miss Peterson, do you want to comment on...
Well, it seems to me that we've had plenty of books about management and factories and big corporations swallowing up little corporations, and I don't think that's interesting at all. I think the human thread gleams through this thing, no matter how flat the writing, and perhaps the writing is flat. I'll go with you there, but the human thing is not flat, and I'm not bleeding about it. On the contrary, I'm not even weeping salt tears about it. I simply feel that you're losing track of the fact that, for one thing, Mr. Sohn has not fallen into the trap of amateur or beginning writers at all, in the sense of trying to tell a story from only one person's point of view. He's not looking out only through the eyes of George Trapple. He's looking out through the eyes of his father and his mother, and even through the eyes of Mary Duncan, his future bride. He does that very well. These people are nice, ordinary, comfortably fixed, middle-class American people. They're quite recognizable. Perhaps you've never met any, Mr. Pauling.
No, I've traveled. I've met them plenty. It isn't that, but if you try and abstract this gleaming thread of yours from the content, from the where he sets the thing, he sets it, as I say, out in East Middleton at first.
Littleton.
All right, Littleton.
We've read the book.
That's unkind, but well deserved.
Well, it's a well-known cliché on the program.
Oh, yes, I know. It comes up. That's why it doesn't disturb me. However, then he comes to New York, and you cannot just talk about George's inner life, which takes place in a vacuum of intelligence, You've got all the same to look at the fixings that he puts it in. He comes to New York and goes off into the advertising business and the radio business. I'm glad to say, and I think perhaps it'll please people in general around here, that he seems to like NBC. He doesn't like radio in general, and I think we'd better not, I don't think you, defending him, had better go too far into what he says about radio in general.
But he likes NBC.
He likes
all
NBC.
All right, fine. Well, then we're doing fine. But now, at the risk of developing a neurosis on the part of our author, Mr. Soane, if he has to remain silent anymore, it is obvious that the holiday spirit has completely departed from Mr. Paulding, and I suppose that by this time it has also departed from Mr. Soane. So I think it's time to hear from our author of the afternoon, Mr. Monty Soane.
This is Nature Boy Soane speaking.
Where's your beard?
I think that Mr. Paulding, in his role of prosecuting attorney, he has a job to do, and if he doesn't get convictions, why, he's going to lose that job. I think he's got me confused. I think he wants me to be, or wanted me to be, a sort of a poor man's Dostoevsky, and I can't be anything but Soane. I've no experience in that line. I know Freud only in a general sense, and I think if I had loaded this book with the Freudian theory, nobody would have read the darn thing. I wanted it to be a human document of people that you and I recognize, people only some of whose difficulties, emotional and other mental difficulties, things that we recognize, and people that are credible. And I don't think we want to get into anything profound to the tune of about a half a million words. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well, one of the best things you did, I think, is the relationship between the father and son, who are fundamentally fond of each other, and the absolute incapacity of them to reach a common ground where they can speak. Everything that Jim, the father, says irritates George in spite of himself, so because he's so exacerbated already, and he willfully misinterprets his father's best intentions. And every effort that Jim makes is frustrated and meets with another setback and gives him a still more grim and lonely feeling. I think that part is extraordinarily well done without being overdone at all. And it would have been tragic if you tried to introduce Freud.
Let me cut in there, Ms. Peterson. Let me cut in there.
Oh, by all means,
I like
Mr.
that part, too, because at one moment Jim says to his son, "My son, you're a rotten young liar." And I think that in spite of every neurosis in the world, George, when he's still out in East Littleton, is not so much a liar, but he flounders around in the most obvious kind of cliches of mental trouble. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that he thinks enough.
But at that particular moment, I believe George had said something peculiarly and viciously insulting to his father about his father's motives and business. People do lose their tempers, Mr. Paulding.
Well, I think
in certain classes, perhaps, really.
I wish you'd answer my point instead of saying...
Maybe Mr. Soane would like to answer it.
Well, now, Mr. Soane, could you tell me why George doesn't do a little bit of more thinking? What is it in his education that makes him quite so inarticulate? Is that part of the neurosis?
Is this another reflection on Yale, Mr. Paulding?
This is getting back to Yale, yes.
Well, Mr. Paulding, I should like to ask a very intimate question which you can answer in writing if you choose. Have you ever suffered from a psychosis? Have you ever gotten up at night 4 or 5 times in the same night to make sure that the same door was locked which you previously unlocked, previously locked? Did you ever go to bed at night convinced that somebody in your family would die before morning unless you did something about it? Have you ever had a nervous breakdown, for one thing?
The way these people on this program are trying to appeal to my heart is simply unbelievable. I've worried like mad all night, but it hasn't been about whether somebody die or something. It's usually about how in the world I'd get through the next day of work.
I think I can answer that question. I've known Mr. Paulding for some time, and I think that it's obvious that he's had a bad nervous breakdown, and probably several of them during the course of his life. I mean, he bears the signs of it.
You mean today, John?
Yes, Mr. Paulding.
Maybe we shouldn't expect a heart of a prosecutor.
All this seems to be fairly irrelevant to the question of the flesh and Mary Duncan, which is, I believe, the point of the program, is it not? What I'd like to bring out another thing which I think is Very modern of Mr. Soane, and it took a little stretching of the imagination for me to grasp it and appreciate it. Stories of sons who rebel against their fathers and do not want to go into their father's profession or business are usually stories about young men who have a passionate desire to paint, to write a book, to compose music, young men of exacerbated genius who feel that their fathers are smothering this budding talent. Here is a young man who finds release, and believe it or not, I find it stretching the imagination, and still it's true, in the advertising business. That's all he wanted. He just wanted to do something of his own. He becomes perfectly normal and happy and works on all four cylinders in the advertising business. Now, I think this is a peculiarly modern touch. I am too old-fashioned to go along with it, but I'm willing to grant that there are hundreds and thousands of young men all over the country now who find release in the advertising business, and even seekers after truth who somehow feel that they've found the truth in advertising.
It doesn't matter where he worked. The point, as far as George Trapel was concerned, is that he was working at something. It could have been any other business as well as the advertising business.
But it so happened that it was the advertising business, and Mr. Soane actually manages to sugarcoat that pill until you almost wish you had a job in it.
Well, Miss Peterson, there again, even when George gets into the advertising business, the intellectual quality of his mind and his work remains just as low as it has throughout. What do you think his extraordinary invention is in research in this job that he gets? Is to find out if radio advertising, the commercial, the sponsors and people in radio, they know how many listeners, or they think they know through Hooper ratings, etc., how many listeners. But the whole point of George's new intellectual pursuit is to find out if they actually sell any goods through radio advertising. That seems to me, my heavens, don't these researchers look up something more interesting than that?
Well, that's very important.
I should think that that would be
Mr.
very interesting to the man who was sponsoring the program, Mr. Paulding.
Sure,
I would just
I'm
think
sure
it would be the, of the deepest
interest. NBC, if I may interject, because when the time comes when NBC no longer sells merchandise as a consequence of radio program, we'll have a beautiful pile and a monument, Mr. Rockefeller, up here.
Well, you're absolutely underlining exactly the point I tried to bring out, that George is pursuing the obvious. I assume naturally that everybody's interested in finding out whether their programs sell merchandise. But it's so obvious. Why can't he have a bright idea?
You see, Mr. Pauling, you're making it impossible for Borden's to take us over, for instance, by what you say.
Well, I just don't think that George is interesting. I like his father better, and that's why I wished the book had been concentrated more on that. Now, here's the real point to get down to hard tacks on this book. Your drama in the book, there is drama, but what is it? It is practically a literal transcript of any number of case histories of interrogations of shot soldiers in hospitals. The scene is a moving scene, but to me it's simply lifted out of some kind of case history.
Well, isn't that fair?
No, I don't think it is. I think a book has to rewrite that stuff. I don't think it should remind you of a literal case history of where when the boy is forced under this drug that they give them to relive the thing that produced
the
neurosis.
Oh, but that's just a flashback. In order to explain for poor George to tell his wife as nearly as he can what happened to him, that's perfectly
sure,
legitimate
to refer
to the treatment.
It's the only exciting writing in the book. Unless you come to what is the end of the book, I mean the climax of the book, in which George finds fortunately for us on the air, Mr. Soane calls the transcendental blessing.
What?
The book is a search for the transcendental blessing.
You're calling a spade an article with which to heave up the earth now, aren't you? What we're trying to say is that George is finally able to consummate his marriage, which he had not been able to do. But I think the description of the struggles and his wife's courage in facing them and her extreme amount of self-discipline and her consistent and tenacious love for him through these difficulties and belief in him is not at all a case history, but a description of a very gallant woman.
I think this byplay is very interesting. I think Mr. Pauling has taken a stand. I'd like to make the point that in doing this job, I was merely trying to be a good reporter. as a consequence of my exposure to a great many hundreds of men in the service, consequent upon my having done a streamlined newspaper for them during the war. Some 50,000 men read them, and I have made friends with a great many hundreds of them. I wrote more than 500,000 words to put this book, to produce this book. Some chapters I wrote as many as 12 or 15 times so that the people could be of convincing reality. In the intimate scenes between George and Mary, I was certain you could do the passion of an affection using only one four-letter word, namely, the word love.
In all this, I hope I succeed. That in itself is a distinction, Mr. Soane.
I think that there's another aspect of this, however, that interested me in reading it, and that is, what, in your opinion, Mr. Soane, could Jim Trapple have done for his son? What could his mother have done for him, other than what they did? They gave him sympathy within the limitations, their own human limitations. But it seems to me that we come out in the early part of the book with a good deal of lack of sympathy for George and his for Jim and his wife.
I'm very happy you raised that question, Mr. McCaffrey, because perhaps there's another novel in that story alone. It has been for centuries, since the dawn of time, an effort on the part of an older generation to bridge the chasm between them and the younger generation. And Jim is merely proving how difficult it is to bridge that chasm. You just can't be young when you are no longer young, and heaven knows I should know that better than anybody here.
And yet, George's constant recriminations against his family for trying to, as he puts it, force him into the business, actually, in the scene where the great fight occurs between George and Jim, Jim says, in his own mind, it goes through his mind, that he'd always accepted the fact that George might want to do something else. He would prefer that he came into the business, but it didn't seem to me that there was so much pressure on George. From Jim, he seemed to be doing a pretty good job of holding it back, as far as I was concerned.
I'm glad you brought that up, too, Mr. McCaffrey. This book, among other clichés, seems to assume that there's an inevitable chasm between generations, even without the war. That's why I think the war neurosis of this young man is gratuitous. It's brought in for dramatic effect. Even without that, the conflict would have existed. Now, those parents were pretty decent parents. I don't think Jim was in any way a tyrant, or I think his pitiful efforts to get his son interested in his business are perfectly characteristic of any man in any profession with any son. It works or it doesn't work, but I don't see where this assumption that there has to be a conflict, that you can't stay young. They weren't mothering this child too much. He wasn't spoiled. I can't see why it's assumed.
Well, I'm glad you brought it up, so we're all happy that you brought it up, Mr. McCaffrey, because there is an unbridgeable chasm between one generation and another, and Mr. Soane is dead right, and there always has been, even among the best-intentioned people. We simply do not look at things the same way, and we cannot present them in a way so that the other generation can grasp it. And the only thing we can do is to cover it over with a rather shaky bridge, which we cross sometimes in moments of the utmost goodwill. And I think that's extremely well brought out. And I disagree with you entirely that it has to be an abuse on the part of one generation or the other to make the chasm. The chasm automatically exists.
Well, only since the modern psychology is determined that
it should exist. Are you a father,
Mr. Sorry, but it's time now for summations, and I'm going to ask each one of you to make a closing statement, a minute without interruption. And while you're preparing your statement, here is a special announcement.
At Kingsbridge Hospital in the Bronx, a young ex-flyer, flat on his back for 3 years now, reads all the books he can get hold of, with the help of a projector which reflects the pages on the ceiling above his head. Before the war, he hadn't time to read much. Now he has too much time, and so he reads. And he's taken to writing poetry. "It was all this reading that started me," he said, "and now I like to write poems. It helps." Another young veteran, one who doesn't have to stay in bed, spends all day close to the books in the library. He used to write poems and stories in school before the war. Now his head is full of shrapnel and he's forgotten how to write, but staying near the books, patiently trying to decipher them, makes him feel quieter and less alone. A new year has started, full of adventures for most of us, but for those disabled men, it may mean still another year shut off from the world, waiting and hoping to get well. One of the ways to make the time seem shorter, and more important still, one of the ways to keep up the courage of these men, whose courage has already met such supreme tests, is to give them a new interest, to open a door into the outside world. One of the best ways to take them out of themselves and the dreary round of operation, convalescence, and then operation again, is to give them what they want to read. They want to read what everyone else is reading and talking about. They want to be part of the world they fought to save. Remember the debt we owe the veterans, a debt that can never be repaid, and send them a new, absorbing book to start the year well. All you have to do is choose something you'd like to read yourself and address it to Kingsbridge Hospital, the Bronx, New York.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, your minute summations are here. Miss Peterson, will you?
Well, I think this story is full of understanding and real kind of pity, not the wrong kind. I think it treats of a theme of paramount importance today in handling the question of how a peace-loving people reacts to the disruption of a war against which we all feel a profound instinct, perhaps more profound than anywhere else in the world. I think this is a story of real, recognizable, middle-class American folk, and that they're up against an astonishing challenge. And I think that this novel, Mr. Sohn, has used to point out that we are really unable to face war without this kind of confusion, that relations between people are extremely difficult to, even with the best will, reconcile. And I think that he has contributed a small but genuine piece of Americana and has shown us to be what we Americans truly are, and that is blundering and lost, but essentially men of goodwill.
All right, Mr. Paulding, your one-minute summation.
Well, I don't mind a completely psychological novel endlessly pursuing a neurosis down the twisting stairways of 600 or 1,000 pages. And I disagree with Mr. Sohn that nobody would read it if he'd written such a novel, because obviously people are very much interested in those novels now that are based on war experiences and are based on exactly what Miss Peterson said, that American inability and that human inability and refusal to accept horror as a natural thing. The only people who accept it are people that we dislike extremely, who make a cult out of accepting it. So that the thesis of the book is entirely acceptable to me. But I don't like the strange kind of confusion there is between a situation which is a constant in human life, that is the father-son situation, the business situation, the career situation, the readjustment of a child, whether he comes back from war or comes out of college, even out of Yale, that is a story. In this case, Mr. Sohn, I think gratuitously, brings in the emotional complement to that story, the relation between this girl and the man.
Now, Mr. Sohn, for your minute of summation.
It's very simple, I think. Mr. Paulding, here on my left, is a gentleman who is a splendid advertisement for excellent and robust health. And when you suffer from that, and I mean that most sincerely, too acutely, you have a congenital unsympathy for anybody who has dared to stray from the line of good health, mental or physical. What has happened to Mary Duncan, and more particularly to George Trappell in this book, his hatred of his job, his neglect of his family and his friends, his fear of bodies, including the body of the woman he loved, and his terrified efforts to run away from all of these, I've tried to make reasonable and understanding, and only you, ladies and gentlemen, can decide whether I've succeeded.
And that, of course, is the purpose of The Author Meets the Critics, so that the people who are most concerned, the readers of books, will make up their minds about all books, and The Flesh and Mary Duncan in particular. But I'm sorry that time's up now for both the author and his critics, and here's our announcer to tell you what lies ahead on our program.
Next week, our guest author will be Ira Hirschman, UNRWA representative of the late F.H. LaGuardia. Mr. Hirschman's new book, The Embers Still Burn, is an account of his two trips to Europe with particular attention paid to our present policy in Germany. Be sure to be with us next week when Ira Hirschman meets his critics. And now, back to John McCaffrey.
Before closing, I'd like to thank Monty Sohn for coming here today to discuss his new book, The Flesh and Mary Duncan. And to thank you, Virgilia Peterson, and you, Governor Paulding, for joining us. This is the kind of a discussion with the same kind of criticism and comment that we like to get. And this is John McCaffrey saying good afternoon for The Author Meets the Critics.
The Author Meets the Critics came to you from the RCA Exhibit Hall in Radio City, is produced by Martin Stone and directed by Lee Jones. This is Mel Brandt speaking. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.